content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are in our second reading from the issue titled The Faces of 2019. It's the year-end issue of the Week magazine. And just as a reminder, this particular show will run the first 2 weeks of the new year as we await the first issue of the Week for 2020. So we'll start today with the editor's letter. On the cusp of a new year, it is customary to express some hope and optimism. Summoning cheery thoughts about 2020, however, requires a bit more sunniness than I suspect, most of you can muster. The year will likely start with the impeachment trial in the Senate, which is sure to degenerate into another depressing display of shameless hypocrisy and post-truth partisanship. The Democratic primaries will follow, unleashing a fresh round of generational warfare that will either leave people under 35 or over that age deeply dissatisfied with the nominee. And then we will move into the general election, which promises to be the ugliest presidential election of our lifetimes. A sustained Category 5 hurricane of negative ads, disinformation of both foreign and domestic origin, and fear bordering on panic. In the Trump era, Republicans and Democrats have come to view each other as invading zombie armies, hell-bent on their America's destruction. The potential for an election disaster is very real. In one possible scenario, President Trump narrowly loses, denounces the results as a fraudulent coup, millions of illegal votes, hacking by Ukraine and China, and refuses to vacate the White House. At his urging, armed supporters battle protesters in the street. Would Mitch McConnell and other Republican leaders insist Trump leave? That's no longer clear. In another scenario, Trump loses the popular vote, but wins again in the Electoral College. Traumatized Democrats can't bear this repeat of 2016 and refuse to accept Trump's legitimacy. An even more perilous scenario, the vote count is too close to call, with confrontational recounts in several swing states and perhaps a Supreme Court intervention. Democracies die, political scientists tell us, when the credibility of elections and vital institutions is eroded and the rule of law is destroyed. Let's hope our democracy can survive the next election and the tumultuous year to come. And we skipped over the best columns last week, so we'll pick up a few of those before we go into the year in review. We'll start with this one called America's Third Party is Under 30, something the editor referenced there in his first letter. Young progressives are a third party trapped in a two-party system, said Derek Thompson. Radicalized by the Great Recession and deeply skeptical of capitalism, young Americans have veered sharply to the left. It's not hard to see why. Americans 55 and older make up less than one-third of the population, but own two-thirds of the nation's wealth. Americans under the age of 40, on the other hand, have less income and wealth than young people of previous decades and are struggling with soaring housing costs, college debt, and anemic salaries. In a 2018 study, 95% of young progressives said that some people's situations are so challenging that no amount of work will allow them to find success. They want the government benefits now primarily focused on older Americans, such as Medicare and tax write-offs for mortgages and capital gains, to be extended to the entire population. Those positions divide young leftists not only from Republicans, but also from older Democrats, who make up nearly 60% of all primary voters. For now, at least, young progressives are a distinct minority and can't win a national election on a platform of generational warfare. This is a column from Germany. Merkel's warning to Germans. After 14 years in office, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has finally visited Auschwitz, said Nico Fried. Merkel has made official visits to other Nazi death camps, and she has traveled to the Yad Vashem Memorial in Jerusalem four times. But it wasn't until earlier this month that she laid a wreath at Auschwitz, where more than 1 million Jews died in the Holocaust. There, she announced Germany's second gift of $67 million to maintain the memorial. Remembering the crime, naming the perpetrators, and honoring the victims with dignity is our responsibility, said Merkel, who will leave office in 2021. Being aware of this responsibility is at the heart of our national identity. These are strong words for Germans to hear, and they are more necessary now that racism, hatred, and historical revisionism are spreading again. In June, a neo-Nazi killed German politician Walter Lübcke. In September, a white supremacist tried to massacre Jews in a synagogue in Halle on Yom Kippur, killing two bystanders when he couldn't get into the building. A survey this year found that 27% of Germans hold anti-Semitic beliefs, while 41% think Jews talk about the Holocaust too much. It's never the wrong time for a German leader to visit Auschwitz, but now was especially timely. And this column comes from Lebanon. Women are leading the charge. The Lebanese woman has finally emancipated herself, said Nai Abi Samra, and she is beautiful in her ferocity. After decades of being submissive and decorative, she has put down her makeup kit and picked up a placard, leading the march against rampant corruption. The mass protests that began in October, triggered by attacks on the popular messaging service WhatsApp, have been led by women. They have organized, mobilized neighbors, and set up protest camps. Their very bodies are on the front line. Women form a human shield, inserting themselves between demonstrators and baton-wielding riot police. And when a cabinet minister's armed bodyguard threatened to open fire on protesters, it was a young woman who delivered a swift and punishing kick to his groin, a moment captured on a video that went viral around the world. It's a revelation for someone like me, who grew up with a free and strong mother and always felt pity, even contempt, for the deferential, superficial women I saw around me. But now I see them all, screaming the cries of anger that I once expressed before I moved abroad. Today's Lebanese woman is standing up not only for democracy, but also for her human rights. She believes in her future, and so do I. And it's time for the year in review. It's a month-by-month summary of the events of the year. It's quite an article. It runs a full 2 pages. So bear with me as we read through the entire summary of the week's year in review. January. The new year brings a new Congress to Washington. Republicans retain the Senate with a 53-47 majority, but Democrats have control of the House for the first time since 2011, with a 36-seat majority. Representative Nancy Pelosi is sworn in once again to be Speaker of the House, but the media lavish more attention on freshman Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez AOC as she's known, is a telegenic 29-year-old New Yorker and Democratic socialist who soon introduces legislation for a Green New Deal that would quickly phase out fossil fuels by 2030 and guarantee a job to every American, all paid for by taxes on the wealthy. In the White House, Donald J. Trump begins the third year of his chaotic presidency in typically combative fashion, refusing to sign a spending bill until Congress agrees to fund his controversial border wall and blaming Democrats for the resulting government shutdown. The polarized nation is divided again by images of a nonviolent stare down on the National Mall between a 16-year-old Kentucky teenager in a Make America Great Again hat and a Native American elder banging a drum. February. The government shutdown, now the longest in U.S. history, ends in compromise. Trump agrees to a spending bill that allots $1.375 billion for wall construction, far less than the $5.7 billion he'd demanded, but somewhat more than the zero Speaker Pelosi had offered him. Elsewhere in Washington, the Senate confirms William Barr, 68, to be the new Attorney General. Despite Barr's expansive views on executive power, Democrats are cautiously hopeful that the career-long Washington insider is enough of an institutionalist to resist any effort by Trump to fire Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Mueller is in the second year of an investigation into contacts between the Trump campaign and Russia during the 2016 election. On Twitter, Trump routinely disparages Mueller's probe as a politically motivated witch hunt. Many Democrats, meanwhile, are convinced that Mueller's findings will be sufficiently damning to see Trump impeached and removed from office. March. Mueller finishes his work and submits his long-awaited report to Barr, who quickly releases his own four-page summary. Mueller found no evidence that Trump or his team criminally conspired with Russia, Barr announces. The Attorney General concedes that Mueller found he could not exonerate Trump of possible crimes in his attempts to obstruct the investigation, but says, "I have concluded that no obstruction occurred." As Democrats cry foul, demanding to see the full report, Trump revels in what he calls a complete and total exoneration. In Virginia, meanwhile, Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign manager, is sentenced to 47 months in jail for bank fraud and tax evasion, with a federal judge later adding 43 months for conspiracy. In New Zealand, a white supremacist gunman kills 51 people at two mosques in the city of Christchurch, live streaming the massacre via a helmet cam to Facebook. The crash of an Ethiopian Airlines passenger jet is the second disaster in 5 months involving a new Boeing 737 MAX, and aviation authorities ground the aircraft until further notice. An investigation soon blames software problems for the crashes. April. The Mueller report is finally released for public consumption, and it's quite different from Barr's summary. It now emerges that Mueller himself wrote to Barr after the summary's release, complaining that the AG did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of the full report. Mueller did indeed find no illegal conspiracy between Trump staffers and Russia, as Barr claimed, but the report details more than 100 furtive contacts, as well as the Trump campaign's clear expectation and desire to benefit from Russian election meddling. As for obstruction of justice, Mueller lays out numerous instances of Trump dangling pardons, encouraging witnesses to lie or dictating false statements, and trying to fire Mueller himself. He declined to recommend prosecution. Mueller will later tell Congress, because of an internal Justice Department policy, against indicting sitting presidents. The policy, Mueller says, is the report's guarded language, leaves only constitutional processes for addressing presidential misconduct. But House Democrats, wary of a backlash, are reluctant to launch impeachment proceedings. I think impeachment's too good for him, Pelosi says. May. As it becomes clear that Trump has survived Mueller's Russia investigation, the field of Democratic candidates vying to depose him in 2020 expands to a historic size. As of May, sitting Senators Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Michael Bennett have all thrown their hats in the ring, along with a half dozen former and current congressmen, including Beto O'Rourke of Texas, and a pair of mayors, New York's Bill de Blasio and Pete Buttigieg, 37, mayor of South Bend, Indiana, population 102,000. Leading the field, however, is Joe Biden, the former vice president. Despite concerns among Democrats about his age, 76, his ongoing verbal gaffes, and his inability to excite the party's progressive base. In Washington, President Trump's blanket refusal to honor subpoenas sparks fresh talk of impeachment. I think we're at an inflection point, said Democratic Representative Ted Lieu. June. In China, an estimated 2 million demonstrators take to the streets of Hong Kong, protesting a bill that would allow criminal extraditions to the Chinese mainland. The bill is seen as a threat to the semi-autonomy of Hong Kong, whose residents enjoy civil liberties not afforded other Chinese citizens. In the UK, Prime Minister Theresa May announces her resignation after repeatedly failing to persuade the British Parliament to approve a deal for leaving the European Union, the so-called Brexit demanded by voters in 2016. In the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea, President Trump becomes the first sitting U.S. president to set foot on North Korean soil, crossing the border to shake hands with murderous dictator Kim Jong-un, which Trump describes as a great honor. July. Wealthy financier Jeffrey Epstein, 66, is arrested in New York on charges of sex trafficking of minors. Epstein was convicted of similar offenses back in 2008, and his rearrest raises questions about the lenience of his previous 13-month jail sentence after prosecutors had identified 36 teenage girls he had abused. The owner of multiple mansions and a private Caribbean island, Epstein had cultivated a network of powerful friends, including Britain's Prince Andrew, former President Bill Clinton, and current President Donald Trump. In Britain, the colorful, ambitious Boris Johnson is elected leader of Britain's Conservative Party and becomes the nation's new prime minister. In the White House, President Trump places a phone call to Volodymyr Zelensky, newly elected president of Ukraine, with national security officials listening and taking notes. August. In El Paso, Texas, a 21-year-old man opens fire in a Walmart store, killing 22 people, most of them Mexican immigrants. The gunman had posted an online manifesto calling his actions a response to the Hispanic invasion of Texas. Just 13 hours later, another troubled youth with a semi-automatic rifle and a 100-round drum magazine opens fire in Dayton, Ohio, killing 9 people, including his own sister, and wounding 27 others in the space of only 32 seconds. In New York, Jeffrey Epstein is found dead in his jail cell, having apparently hanged himself, despite what was supposed to be round-the-clock surveillance. Also in New York, Greta Thunberg, a 16-year-old Swedish climate change activist, arrives to much fanfare, having crossed the ocean on a zero-emission sailboat. A bloody month concludes with more carnage when a gunman speeds away from a traffic stop near Odessa, Texas, and shoots dead 7 motorists at random before being killed by police. September. Greta Thunberg delivers a blistering speech to the United Nations. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, the teenager angrily tells the assembled world leaders, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you? The next day, Trump sarcastically tweets, "She seems like a very happy young girl," but he is soon distracted by other matters. Michael Atkinson, Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, alerts House Democrats that he has received a whistleblower's complaint of urgent concern relating to President Trump's July 25th phone call with Ukraine's President Zelensky. With details of the call leaking, the White House releases a rough transcript in which Zelensky asks to purchase more U.S. Javelin missiles to help resist the encroachment of Russian forces. And Trump replies, I would like you to do us a favor, though. Trump proceeds to ask Zelensky to launch a pair of investigations, one into a convoluted theory that Ukraine, not Russia, hacked the Democratic National Committee in 2016, and another into unfounded allegations that Joe Biden, while vice president, intervened to block investigations of a Ukrainian natural gas company where his son Hunter was a board member. Democrats are disgusted by Trump's blatant attempt to get a foreign country to manufacture dirt on his possible 2020 adversary, and Pelosi announces a formal impeachment inquiry into President Trump for his betrayal of his oath of office, betrayal of our national security, and betrayal of the integrity of our elections. October. Insisting his conversation with Zelensky was a perfect call, President Trump denounces the impeachment probe as a coup and orders all current and former administration officials to refuse to cooperate. But several former diplomats testify in defiance of Trump, and a fuller picture emerges of Trump's interest in Ukraine. The Zelensky call, it turns out, was preceded by Trump's order freezing $391 million in congressionally allocated military aid to Ukraine, and a months-long effort by Rudolph Giuliani, Trump's personal lawyer, to have Ukraine announce investigations into Democrats. Gordon Sondland, Trump's ambassador to the EU, admits telling Ukrainian officials that unless Zelensky publicly announced the investigations, the military aid would not be released. Meanwhile, Daryl Morey, general manager of the NBA's Houston Rockets, tweets and quickly deletes a message of support for the ongoing protest in Hong Kong. The outraged Chinese government cancels upcoming NBA games in China and suspends NBA sponsorship by Chinese firms. This prompts a series of craven statements from NBA officials and players, including superstar LeBron James, usually an outspoken champion of social justice, who chides Morey for failing to consider how his comments could have harmed people, not only financially, but physically, emotionally, spiritually. In Syria, ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is killed in a raid by U.S. Special Forces. Osama bin Laden was very big, acknowledges President Trump, but this is a man who built a hole, as he would like to call it, a country, a caliphate. November. Impeachment hearings continue in the House, with a parade of diplomats confirming the existence of a secret Trump-ordered effort to have Ukraine assist with President's re-election campaign. One, David Holmes, recalls Sondland telling him that Trump does not give a blank about Ukraine or its war with Russia and only cares about big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation. Biden himself, meanwhile, is still the Democratic frontrunner ahead of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, although Pete Buttigieg tops the polls in Iowa and New Hampshire, the first two primary states. The rest of the field has thinned somewhat since the spring, but billionaire former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, 77, suddenly jumps into the race, expressing widespread Democratic anxiety that Trump would eat alive any of the other candidates in the 2020 election. And December. Boris Johnson's Conservative Party wins big in the UK elections, all but guaranteeing that Britain will finally leave the European Union in 2020. In Washington, Democrats conclude their public impeachment hearings and draft two articles of impeachment accusing President Trump of abuse of power and obstruction of justice. The stage is set for a January trial in the Senate. The Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell does his best to tamp down suspense, assuring Fox News host Sean Hannity that we all know how it's going to end. There's no chance the president's going to be moved from office. And there you have, folks, the week's version of the year in review. We'll read the last word feature article as well. Appropriate for 2019. It's about Ukraine. And the title is, "It's Never Quiet on Ukraine's Russian Front." The Trump administration kept military aid in limbo for months to pressure Ukraine's new president, said journalist Christopher Miller in BuzzFeedNews.com. Meanwhile, on the front lines, Ukrainians are still dying. Novoulesandrivka, Ukraine. When he's not engaged in gun battles with Russian-led forces on Ukraine's eastern front line, Stas, a scruffy 26-year-old soldier, likes to cozy up in his bunker and brush up on his English skills by watching Stephen Colbert and Saturday Night Live. He cracks up at Alec Baldwin's portrayal of President Donald Trump. Watching political satire on American TV when he's able to get a strong enough signal on the battlefield to access YouTube is also how Stas learned that Trump had frozen $391 million in U.S. security aid meant for the Ukrainian armed forces over the summer. The news made him angry. The fighting was hot at the time, and he and his fellow soldiers were stuck with second-rate gear. "Look at this. It's old and falling apart," he complained of his Ukrainian government-issued bulletproof vest in accented English. "It was barely stitched together and slouching on one side. It's a piece of blank." There's one thing Stas and the soldiers in Ukraine's 72nd Mechanized Brigade, positioned in the village of Novoulesandrivka, do have, which they say has helped them spot enemy soldiers who creep within grenade-throwing range of their trenches at night. A pair of U.S.-made night vision sights. The only problem? They don't fit on the Ukrainian rifles. He explained that they would definitely be more effective if we had them on our rifles, which is impossible without a special adapter. He demonstrated how he has to hold the sight in one hand, pick a target, lower the device from his eye, and try to remember where he was looking as he aims and fires his weapon. "Nobody in your country knows what's happening here," Stas continued, waving his arms in frustration. "They don't know how we are fighting for our lives with almost nothing." Fought for more than 5 years in trenches, cut through some of Europe's most fertile farmland, Russia's war in the eastern Ukrainian region of Donbas has killed around 14,000 people and brought under Russian control a chunk of territory larger than the state of New Jersey. Yet despite being fought with $1.6 billion of U.S. help since 2014, the war had largely been forgotten in the U.S. before it was catapulted into the headlines by revelations that President Trump froze U.S. security aid for Ukraine to pressure the country's new president, Volodymyr Zelensky, into investigating Trump's political rival. The aid freeze was overturned in September, but the damage was already done. "While they were playing with our aid, I wonder, did they know we were dying out here?" asked Oleksandr, a sergeant in the 14th Mechanized Brigade, who goes by the call sign Kuvrak, or Somersault. "As we crept through the trenches outside the village of Kremsky, 40 miles south of Stas' position, careful to keep our heads down and out of Russian sniper sights. Oleksandr said at least 2 soldiers were killed at the position over the summer. The warring sides in Krymsky, which is accessible only over a cratered dirt road that winds through a field of dead sunflowers, are so close that they can see each with the naked eye across a desolate no man's land where only feral dogs dare to roam. Underscoring the danger there, in the days after I visited his position, the brigade lost 2 more men, including 32-year-old Artem Sokolov, who was killed by a sniper. The soldiers, whom I met over the course of a week in October, while traveling along the snaking 250-mile front line in eastern Ukraine, painted a clear picture of just how important U.S. military assistance is for Ukraine in its war against Russia. The soldiers spoke on the condition that their surnames not be used for security reasons. In what many described as a David and Goliath-like fight, they shared stories about how the U.S. aid has helped level the battlefield and stop the larger and more powerful Russia from grabbing more of their land. The war exploded in 2014, shortly after Ukrainian revolutionaries ousted kleptocratic former President Viktor Yanukovych, and Russia responded by invading and annexing Crimea. Eventually, with Western help, Ukraine's military got back on its feet and halted Russia's advance, but not before much of Donbass was lost or destroyed. Today, much of the region is a battle-scarred wasteland. The front line that slices through it divides 6 million people, 2 million living on the government-controlled side, and 4 million under Russia's control. With thousands of apartment buildings and private homes badly damaged or destroyed, people who didn't have the money to flee, or didn't have family elsewhere to stay with, or had a disability, or were too stubborn to go elsewhere, have been forced to rough it. They shack up in crumbling homes patched together with tape and plastic tarps, and they huddle in dark, dank basements with no ventilation, where at least they believe they're safe from shelling. Desperate, many people have hung religious icons over their doors in hope that somebody above is looking out for them. Some 75 miles southwest of Stas' position, past sandbag checkpoints and over roads badly chewed up by military vehicles, lies the city of Avdiivka, where Svetlana Zakevich is the librarian at school number 6. Saskevich lives with her husband in the old part of the city. In her neighborhood, there's hardly a home that hasn't been hit by gunfire or leveled by artillery shells. "So many people and families have been killed," she said. "Long gone are the days when she could stroll to the park with her family or take her students on field trips. Instead," she says, "everyone sits at home because it's just too dangerous to go outside." For those living in the crossfire, life is measured in minutes and feet. Stepping out at the wrong time of day or to the wrong side of the road can mean death. Everyone's future is uncertain. Dozens of civilians with whom I spoke said they hoped their new president could strike a deal to end more than 5 years of fighting. Zelensky met with Russian President Vladimir Putin earlier this month on neutral ground in Paris. In their first face-to-face meeting, the two leaders failed to find common ground on the key issues of border control and local elections, but reached a limited agreement to exchange prisoners, recommit to implementing an oft-violated ceasefire, and open 3 new crossing points by spring. They are supposed to meet again in 4 months to try for a more permanent end to the Donbas conflict. In the meantime, Ukrainian troops are holding their line. While a stark improvement in fighting ability and professionalism since the early days of the war is noticeable at the front line, everything from the soldiers' uniforms to their arms remains unsophisticated. Their ambulances are rusty Soviet-made off-road vehicles that look like Volkswagen buses. Their operating buses are ramshackle cottages and garages polka-dotted with bullet holes. and their guns are Kalashnikov rifles from aging stockpiles, reliable but inaccurate. Indeed, the bits and pieces that remind you that the war is being fought in 2019 are few and far between, and many have come from Washington. They include counter-battery radar systems, Humvee ambulances, night vision sights, Raven drones, bulletproof vests, modern medical equipment, and battlefield first aid kits. The Ukrainians' prized possessions might be the lethal Javelin anti-tank missiles approved and delivered by the Trump administration last year, but on the condition they're used only in the event of a large-scale Russian offensive. Until then, they're being stored in secure locations behind the front line. That's not to say all the American aid works well. For instance, the radars don't always pick up smaller artillery fire. The drones are prone to Russian jamming and hacking. The medical scanners run on two different voltages than in Ukraine. And the Humvees suck up gas and aren't armored. Still, without it, they would be worse off, soldiers say. Yuri Krupko, deputy commander of Ukraine's 28th Mechanized Brigade, told a story that painted a clear picture of how U.S. aid helps them. It was 2016, and grenades and mortars were crashing down in rapid succession, wreaking havoc on Ukrainian positions on the edge of Stanitsa Luhanska. Krupko didn't know where the artillery was coming from, but could tell it was somewhere beyond the opposing hillside. He also knew that if he didn't stop the bombardment soon, his brigade could lose several soldiers and a foothold in the country's eastern war zone. In the melee, Krupko switched on a counter-battery radar system that had been delivered to Ukraine as part of a U.S. military aid package. He pinpointed the incoming fire and predicted his enemy's next moves. Soon after, the Ukrainians unleashed their own barrage and watched the smoke rise from the enemy's firing positions. "We totally destroyed them," Krupko said. "U.S. military equipment saves our butts every day," he added, gesturing to a group of soldiers filing into a chow hole after a tank exercise not far from the front line last week. "And not only our butts," he continued, "but the butts of the entire Ukrainian armed forces." I heard more about that in Avdiivka's Prom Zone, a Mad Max-like industrial wasteland filled with the detritus of war that serves as the base for Ukraine's 92nd Mechanized Brigade. There, a chain-smoking officer with piercing blue eyes by the name of Valentin showed off an American Humvee ambulance. "It's great, but not for the very front line. It's not armored, and it's too high. It makes us a mark when we're driving it," he said as he revved it up. "You have to be a kamikaze to take it out there. But it's better quality than what we had before." It's gotten a lot of use in Avdiivka, where fighting has been heavy for years as it has abated in other places along the front line. The Ukrainian military suffers casualties there on an almost daily basis. But ask any soldier if they'll back down, and they'll tell you, hell no. "I don't know what the size of the balls on your guys over there is in the U.S., growled Oleksandr, the sergeant in Kaminsky, cradling a rifle in his arms. "But we have guys with huge ones here." To reach the forsaken village of Optin, I had to drive over a makeshift dirt road that cuts through a minefield. On the other side, I met Maria Hortnich, a spirited 80-year-old who referred to herself as Baba, or Grandma. Marcia and she said she wanted nothing more than to see the war end. Hortnich was born as World War II broke out, she told me, at her modest cottage, which has fallen into disarray after being pummeled by mortars and rockets, a consequence of living within sight of the destroyed Donetsk airport. She said she hoped not to die in another war. In far-flung Opinti, which more than 300 people used to call home, word of Trump's decision to delay U.S. aid hadn't yet reached the 39 elderly residents who remain. They don't have electricity, and phone service is shoddy. The roads are terrible and treacherous, so the news is slow to reach the village. There's also no running water and no gas to heat homes. "We are only surviving," Horpnich said. With a heavy sigh, she added, "We used to have everything here. There were children playing in the streets." If the war comes to an end, soldiers and residents in eastern Ukraine will be able to begin piecing their lives back together. For Horpnich, that would mean she could visit the grave of her son, Viktor. In 2015, he'd gone outside to help a neighbor fix a broken gas pipe. Not long after, that neighbor came running over to say that Viktor had been hit in the head with shrapnel from a rocket that had exploded beside them. It was too dangerous outside for Horpnich to make it to the cemetery to bury her son, so she placed Viktor's body in a makeshift coffin and buried him in a shallow crater left by another rocket in her yard. His body stayed there for 5 months until she was able to exhume him and give him a proper burial. "War is misery," she said. "I wish it would end soon and we could live in peace." Horpnich wouldn't get that chance. A little more than 2 weeks after we met, she died in a fire after an oil lamp or candle she used to light her cottage fell over and set it ablaze. A version of this article originally appeared in BuzzFeedNews.com. Back to the year in review theme, we're on the best books of the year. For the Critics' Choice, the year's best novels, they picked the number one as The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead. Colson Whitehead can succeed at any novel he takes on, says Sam Sachs in the Wall Street Journal. The 2017 Pulitzer Prize winner chose to forego any flashes of whimsy or magic realism in his latest effort. But the book doesn't need them. It takes a grim, true story about a 20th century Florida reform school at which black students were routinely beaten and often murdered, and makes the horror vivid. His protagonist is a model teenager who's been unjustly confined to the Nickel Academy, and the young man's experience inside culminates in a dazzling final twist that Whitehead stages with such casual skill that one only begins to unpack its meanings well after the book has ended. Elwood's best friend inside is less trusting than he that justice will prevail, and the pair regularly debate the nature of the world they live in, said Anna Devere Smith in the New York Review of Books. Only one viewpoint can prevail in this profoundly sad but elegant novel, yet in the toxic place fate has consigned them to, their comradeship is the hope. That's The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead. The other top five novels, and we won't read the description, but they have number two, Trust Exercise by Susan Choi. Number three, Lost Children Archive by Valeria Lucelli. Number four, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong. And number five, The Topeka School by Ben Lerner. The top five novels. And the year's best nonfiction, their number one choice is titled Say Nothing by Patrick Radden Keefe. Patrick Radden Keefe's true crime masterpiece is a perfect example of how to take a brutal crime and use it to tell in page after gripping page a much larger history, said Time. In 1972, Irish Republican Army militants abducted and shot Jean McConville, a widowed 38-year-old mother of 10, on suspicion that she was a British informant. She likely wasn't, and her captors, who considered themselves freedom fighters, spent decades haunted by their actions, especially because the bloodshed never resulted in their achieving the goal of a united Ireland. Keefe, a New Yorker writer, contends that Gerry Adams, who in 1972 was commander of the IRA's Belfast branch, ordered McConville's murder, said Jonathan Stevenson in Foreign Affairs. When Adams restyled himself in the 1980s as a peace-brokering politician and denied having been an IRA member, his former foot soldiers felt doubly betrayed. Regardless of which of them fired the fatal shot, and Keefe offers a plausible theory, the true significance of McConville's death lies in what it reveals, that political violence disfigures society as a whole, whether with guilt or with grief, even decades after the fighting has stopped. That's Say Nothing by Patrick Radden Keefe. The other of the top five nonfiction books, number two, they have The Yellow House by Sarah M. Broom. Number three is In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado. Number four is Know My Name by Chanel Miller. And number five is Underland by Robert McFarland. For the health and science year in review, they divide it into some of the things they said were good for us and some of the things we were told to avoid, and the big scientific breakthroughs of 2019. We'll sample a little of each. So, some of the things they said were good for us. Napping may boost your heart health. That's the finding of researchers in Switzerland who tracked 3,462 healthy adults for 5 years. Those who dozed for 5 minutes to an hour once or twice a week were 48% less likely to suffer heart attack, stroke, or heart failure than those who never snoozed in the daytime. Napping longer or more often didn't deliver any additional health benefits. Lead author Nadine Hausler said it's still unclear how napping might influence heart health. Our best guess, she says, is that a daytime nap just releases stress from insufficient sleep. And speaking of stress, they say NSAIDs, such as aspirin and ibuprofen, may help relieve depression. In an analysis of previous studies, researchers in China found that a daily dose of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, was 79% more effective than a placebo at eliminating depressive symptoms. Several studies have linked depression to brain and body inflammation, leading to speculation that an overactive immune system, which can cause inflammation, could be a factor. Alan Carson, who edited the study, says depression may simply be the price we pay for having an immune system. High-fiber foods could shrink your risk of dying early or developing a chronic condition. A scientific review commissioned by the World Health Organization noted that people who ate the most fiber, found in fruit, vegetables, and whole grain cereals, pasta, and bread, were 15 to 30% less likely to die prematurely than those who ate the least. Heavy fiber consumers were also 16 to 24% less likely to suffer a stroke or develop heart disease, type 2 diabetes, or colorectal cancer. The optimal fiber intake was 25 to 29 grams a day. American adults consume an average of 15 grams. A few other things they said were good for us: eating mushrooms, having kids once they've grown up and moved out, running, and Northern Irish soil. I'll leave that one for you to look up if you're interested. Some of the things they told us to avoid: vaping may damage blood vessels. Using MRI scans, University of Pennsylvania scientists monitored blood flow in 31 non-smokers. After participants had several puffs on an e-cigarette without a flavor or nicotine, their blood flow was noticeably worse. Overall, vaping temporarily constricted arteries in the legs, heart, and brain by more than 30%. The researchers believed glycerol and propylene glycol, the core ingredients of vape fluids beside water, can irritate the lining of blood vessels. More than 2,400 people have been hospitalized over the past year for vaping-related lung illnesses, and at least 52 have died. Scientists suspect many had vaped illicit liquids containing THC, the psychoactive compound in marijuana, that had been cut with vitamin E acetate, a sticky oil that can cling to the lungs. Ultra-processed foods can shorten your life. A French study found that every 10% increase in consumption of these foods, such as chicken nuggets, potato chips, and ready-to-eat meals, was linked to a 14% higher risk of early death. The researchers say some additives in ultra-processed products are carcinogenic and that chemicals from packaging may leak into the foods. Co-author Mathilde Touvier recommends people avoid these foods as much as they can. Getting a tattoo can put toxic metal fragments into your body. German scientists examined 12 new steel tattoo needles with a high-powered microscope, both before and after use. They found that chromium and nickel particles break off during the tattooing process and become embedded in the skin. Those metals can travel through the body and build up in lymph nodes, potentially triggering an allergic reaction. Anyone thinking of getting inked, said lead author Ines Shriver, should be aware that they could be exposed to impurities that might be allergenic or carcinogenic. Also on the list of things we were told to avoid, playing soccer, aspirin, doctors' coats, and white meat. But we'll leave it at that. The big scientific breakthroughs of 2019, capturing a black hole. Scientists this year unveiled the first ever image of a black hole. One of the universe's most enigmatic phenomena, a black hole is a cosmic abyss so dense with matter that not even light can escape. The picture from Messier 87, a galaxy 55 million light years away, shows a bright ring of particles heated to billions of degrees, circling a supermassive black hole some 25 billion miles wide. To capture this image, scientists focused 8 ultra-powerful radio telescopes around the world on Messier 87 for 10 days. Researchers compared the resulting images to millions of simulations of what the black hole might look like and found a match. We have seen what we thought was unseeable, said project leader Shep Dolman. The new CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R. Scientists have developed a gene editing tool that could one day correct 89% of the genetic mutations that cause inherited diseases such as cystic fibrosis and sickle cell anemia. The most popular existing gene editing approach, CRISPR-Cas9, uses molecular scissors to locate faulty genetic code, then cuts both strands of DNA double helix and splices in a new section of code. Though cheap and fast, this process often damages nearby code or inserts the new material in the wrong place. The new technology, known as prime editing, cuts only one strand of the double helix, minimizing the risk of unintended changes. Also, big scientific breakthroughs of 2019, fighting Ebola, mind-reading robo-suit, and a blood test for Alzheimer's. And we'll wrap up with a few short notes, starting with, after a big marketing push on social media, Mariah Carey's holiday staple, All I Want for Christmas Is You, hit number one on the Billboard Singles Chart this week for the first time since it was released in 1994, with more than 45 million plays on streaming services in 1 week alone. Nearly 250,000 fewer students enrolled in college this fall than a year ago, continuing a decline that has seen nationwide enrollment drop about 11%, or 2.3 million, since 2012. Researchers attribute the decline to low unemployment, the rising cost of college, and a falling national birth rate. Russian state television has been gloating over President Trump's Oval Office photo with Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov, with Russia One airing a segment called Puppet Master and Agent. On another show, TV host Vladimir Soloviev joked that the Kremlin might have to get another apartment in Rostov ready if Trump loses the election, a reference to Viktor Yanukovych, the pro-Kremlin former president of Ukraine, who fled to Russia after he was ousted from power. And we'll finish our 2019 readings with a quote appropriate for the year from poet Stephen Dunn, who says, "The truth is always different from what anyone says out loud." And that's it for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next week. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Got any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.